Before we get to the interview, I'd like to tell you about a special offer to subscribe to the Business Observer, which covers essential business news on the West Coast of Florida, every day online and every Friday with a print edition. Unlock every Business Observer article on our website, along with our newspaper app, for only $1 a week. Sign up today and stay up to date on all the business news you need to be better at business. Go to businessobserverfl.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome to the Business Observer from the Corner Office podcast. I'm Mark Gordon, Managing Editor of the Business Observer. Today's guest is Jay Girado, President of Farmland Opportunity. Jay, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Excellent. So we're, you know, somewhere high 30s, low 40s in episodes of this podcast. And I'm pretty sure you're the first farmer. I'm sure you're the first farmer who also worked at Microsoft. So you've done all these really cool and interesting things in your career, and now you're in Sarasota, Florida. So I'm going to start with, tell us about yourself. Tell us about Farmland Opportunity and kind of about your career.
Yeah, sure. Just happy to give a short background, and we can talk about details from there. But so for the past 15 years, I've been running my company called Farmland Opportunity, which makes direct investments in U.S. row crop farmland. Row crops are things that you plant every year. So it's global commodities like corn and soybeans and wheat and things like legumes and canola, alfalfa, things like that. So that company really was spurred in 2009 by the behest of some friends of my wife and I to start buying and owning farmland for long-term ownership individually. As not only a great financial investment, but also a way to, you know, build a legacy and a multi-generational attachment to the land. We also do a lot of things related to renewable energy around wind power and solar power on certain farms. And so it was just a great vehicle for families and individuals to get more involved in terms of a legacy and planning. And it's something that we had been doing as a family. My wife grew up on a farm in Wisconsin. I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. My parents grew up in Kansas, in Western Kansas. And we had been doing it ourselves. And I was just delighted with the opportunity to work with other families to do the same thing for them. And it was born pure out of happenstance in that way at a reunion that we had gone to. And I was effectively drafted and said, hey, we should go do this at a broader scale.
It's interesting too, because, you know, so that's like you said 2009, so that's roughly 15 years. And, you know, the industry's always changing, but I feel like the last decade for farming has certainly been very challenging, you know, whether it's COVID or regulations or laws per state. What's sort of the mission of your Farmland Opportunity right now, and kind of what are you guys doing?
Yeah, so we've really stuck with the underlying, you know, strategy that we started with. There have been a lot of, you know, potential distractions over time, but we stuck with the model of direct ownership of the farmland. So in our structure is an individual like our family or a family that's a client of ours actually owns the farmland themselves. You know, fee simple on a deed, just like you own your house. So we aren't structured as a fund or real estate investment trust. You know, we're not publicly traded or anything like that. And then we turn around and we lease that farm back to local farm operations in the 12 states that we operate in, which are basically in the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest. And that model is fairly, you know, different for, you know, outside investors in the agriculture space. There's, you know, I don't, you know, 40 plus, you know, investment funds and a couple publicly traded REITs and things like that. And so we really built it that way, because we were interested in, you know, individuals and families like us that wanted to have, you know, long-term generational ownership of the land itself, to be personally invested in it, to take care of it over very long periods of time, and not to be transactional, you know, in nature of it. And I think that reflects a lot of, you know, the values in the background of the whole, you know, agricultural sector, you know, in the United States. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you've heard many stories like this. You probably have clients or partners like this, you know, just for example, in East Manatee County right now, there's a family owned dairy farm that's been put up for sale and they want to keep it as a farm, but the likelihood of it going to a developer is relatively high, and that's causing some consternation in the community.
Sure. Yeah, that we do see that at, you know, I guess maybe a smaller scale than, you know, the Gulf Coast of Florida, where development pressure is huge. Right.
Right.
You know, but we do see that in a different way, you know, just in very remote areas, you know, of states with lots of land. I agree. You see that dynamic a lot. And we are, you know, with our approach, we are, you know, often seen much more as a local buyer, you know, who's going to keep it in agriculture, who's going to rent it and lease it out to a local family. And the you know, just the fact of life is that, you know, the farmland values are, you know, are high enough at this point, right? And the other, you know, capital requirements around farming, whether that's equipment, you know, that's inputs like fertilizer and seed and things like that, are large enough that you know, every farmer can't, you know, buy every farm that's for sale, right?
Yeah.
And so it just simply doesn't work that way. And we, you know, we lease to 106 farm families. And I think if you've talked with any of them, they look at us as a partner in which they can, you know, expand and grow their family business. You know, they can't buy every farm that they could farm, but we can partner with them, supply the capital and buy the farm, lease it to them. That allows them to get more family members or expand their business. It allows them to use their capital equipment, which is obviously very expensive, like tractors and planters and combines, allows them to use that, you know, on more acres, right? Which makes them more efficient.
Yeah. All right. So you've done farming, and you mentioned your family was farming, but you've also had some other sort of stops in your career.
Yeah.
Microsoft. Tell us about what you did at Microsoft. That's pretty cool. But I'd like to hear a little bit more about your work there and what you did.
Yeah, so I guess the journey to Microsoft really started in business school. So we graduated, both my wife and I graduated from Harvard Business School in 1999, which was the top of the dot-com bubble. It was, I believe, the only year that Harvard Business School sent more people somewhere else than New York City in terms of their graduates. And that was San Francisco, of course.
Wow, yeah.
We went. And so we were some of the folks that, you know, went through the dot-com, I guess, you know, bubble and crisis and actually stayed in software and technology. And so my wife continues to be a technology marketing executive. I had two startups that I was with. One of them called Homestead.com was bought by Intuit. A second one called Demand Tech was eventually taken public. And then after it was public, it was bought by IBM. But at that time, this would have been, you know, just prior to joining Microsoft, we moved to Kirkland, Washington, next to Microsoft in Redmond, Washington. Right. And my view was at that point that I wanted to start my own, you know, technology oriented business. And I had not thought through the depth of what, you know, people mean to actually starting that. And I didn't have a technical co-founder, you know, in the greater, you know, Kirkland, Bellevue, you know, Seattle area to partner with. And so instead of starting a software company at that point, I actually decided to join Microsoft and see where things, you know, went from there. And I think that was, you know, circa maybe 2003, 2004, when that happened. And so I spent that next period of my career, you know, 5 years, a little more than 5 years, you know, at Microsoft in a couple different roles. You know, one inside of Windows security, one in search before, you know, it was Bing. You know, at that time, it was transitioning from MSN search into the more broader search engine that people see today. And then I also worked with a smaller group that did sort of startup based things inside of Microsoft as well before leaving there in 2009, 2010.
So you have some really interesting experience, right? You did startups and then you kind of worked within a startup within Microsoft. What are some lessons that you learned to start with Microsoft? Obviously a huge organization, you know, yep. What makes them successful? What are some things that you look back on that time period and, you know, sort of share with other business owners that made Microsoft work?
Yes. Yeah. So that's a very interesting time that I was at Microsoft. That was during the period of time that Steve Ballmer was the CEO. And Microsoft was really, I think, struggling to find its footing, you know, post, you know, Bill Gates, basically, right? You know, sort of stepping out of the CEO role, becoming chairman, you know, kind of there around 2000, that time frame. And so it was really my only, as a career wise, my only large corporate experience too, you know? And I think I saw a lot of positives, but I would say that, you know, it also is something that you really need to be a fit for, right? In terms of what you want in your career, progression. And I think I recognized during that period, that probably wasn't the best fit for my skill set. Right. And my skill set was much more general management, entrepreneurial oriented. Yeah. And it did also, you know, enlighten me to more, you know, sort of overall thinking, which is, you know, you got to really do something that you're very, very passionate about. Right. And I think, you know, diversification, you know, in your career might not be the best thing. Right. You know, pick something that you're really good at, you really like to do. And pursue that passion. And, you know, I had for that, you know, first 10 years of my career and for 2 years at Bain & Company, which obviously a general management consulting thing out of college, had really just kind of been building, you know, a set of sort of, you know, generalist, you know, skill set, right. That had been playing there. And, you know, that really wasn't something that, worked inside of Microsoft's, you know, corporate structure in terms of how, you know, you want to be a really good engineer, right? Or you want to, yeah, you know, really good in some discipline, right? You know, in order to move forward. And I think it really enlightened me into the fact of what my skill set was. It was very good in teaching me that. I mean, lots of, you know, programs to, you know, figure out what you're good at and evaluate your leadership style and things like that. And it really instructed me on where to go next.
You know, you talk about the leadership style, you mentioned Bain & Company, so I'm sure you learned some things, yep, from there. And Microsoft was sort of famous for a time during Bill Gates for being very structured with its leadership. And you know, I think, yep, they took some from GE and sort of that, you know, I think Bill Gates has talked about that. What's your leadership style? How have you sort of honed your leadership style over your career?
Yeah, I mean, so we're a small organization. Our Farmline Opportunity is a very, right, small team. You know, it's, you know, in, you know, high single digits, right? When you look at people who, you know, work directly or are critical, you know, partners with us. And so with our team and managing Farmline Opportunity, it has been about finding, and when I say finding, I mean, you know, I'm talking about spending 3, 4, 5 years, you know, recruiting a person, you know, into a specific position where,
really, wow,
they get to know us, we get to know them. They, you know, we decide and they decide that this is something they're passionate about, that they want to drive, that, you know, it's something they want to do basically for the rest of their career, right? You know, in terms of what they're doing. And so our, you know, leadership, I guess your direct question around leadership style and how run the current business is really deeply around those partnerships and long-term relationships, right? We really only had one person that joined, was with the team for 6, 7 years, that left the team. That's it. Otherwise we've had zero team turnover at all through the organization. So, yeah. And I would say the leadership style, both people on the team, myself, is very collaborative. You know, we love coming into work every day. You know, if you don't do that, then either something's wrong or you should be doing something else, right? There's no reason to show up and go to work if you don't like what you're doing, right? Yeah. You know, that's the absolute worst situation. And And that extends out to the, you know, the 100 plus farmers that we work with and we lease farms to, as well as another set of partners, whether that's in renewable energy space, whether that's with our real estate lawyers, you know, that assist us in the 12 states. You know, it's set up as that. And I would even say that extends out to, you know, other, you know, real estate firms in the agricultural space. You know, I think we tend to lead with, even though in some cases we might be competitive, you know, on certain deals, there's other cases where we can be collaborative around things that are going on and share learnings around farm management or various, you know, other technology areas. And so I think we're definitely seen in the space as being part of the, you know, the greater, you know, I guess, you know, solution or things that are moving the ball forward for agriculture generally. Yeah.
Outside of agriculture, what have you learned throughout your career, Bain & Company, Microsoft, that advice that you would give to startups? And you've been involved in different startups, and at one point, yeah, Farmland Opportunity was a startup. So what kind of advice would you give to, you know, any kind of startup, a restaurant, a technology company, anything?
Yeah, and I definitely reflected on this a bit, I think the thing that I would say most predominantly comes through that whole, you know, arc that you just described and career and things like that is that there's a real skill around preserving optionality that is extremely important, whether it's a entrepreneurial, you know, starting a company or even, you know, even at a larger organization and things like that. And when I say preserving optionality, I'm talking about everything, whether that's, you know, in a land transaction or trying to negotiate, right, with different parties and things like that, whether that's a business decision that you need to make, but you want to get maybe some more data or more information, or you want to hear from this party before you're committed to a path that you can't change from without a large cost, you know, whether it's dollars or people or whatever it is. And so I think that is a skill set that's not really very talked about, you know, amongst people about how do you actually in different situations preserve a set of optionality to allow you to get to the best outcome, right? Without, you know, sort of, you know, breaking down your choices to a point that you've gone past a point of no return or a very costly point. Yeah.
It's interesting, right? You think about we're so cued in business and we got to make decisions and make decisions, and that's fine. But you're saying is interesting, right? It's keep your options open too, and be judicious about it, almost not be so quick to make that decision.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that when I say preserving optionality, that means, you know, not, like you're not making decisions or what. Yeah. It's, I think that a lot of decisions can be made, I guess, in multiple steps, right?
Yeah.
Rather than, and so you are on a path or you are, you know, being decisive about things, but even though you're being decisive, you haven't eliminated your options, you know, the other paths that you can go down.
Yeah. Who are some of your key mentors in your career, you know, changing gears a little bit, who are some people that stand out in your mind and what have you learned from them?
Yeah. So I think, you know, certainly the biggest mentor and sort of role model would have been my father. My parents graduated from KU in 1958, 1959. They had come from farm towns basically in Kansas. They had decided not to go back and become farmers. My mom was a music teacher. My dad was an electrical engineer, and he took a job at a company called Collins Commercial Avionics in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, right around 1960. That is a very interesting company to look at in the history of American sort of technical development that most people don't know about. It was founded by a guy named Art Collins, who started building radios that were better than the US military during World War II. And sort of, he got pulled into the US military operations in World War II. And then after World War II, spun that out into a commercial company at the dawn of commercial aviation. And when he joined that, it was basically a startup, and going through, you know, different things that they struggled with doing. I mean, you know, basically Collins designed all the flight control systems that you would see in modern aircraft today. Simple things like gyroscopes, the artificial horizon, you know, proximity detection, you know, radios and things like that. And, right. It's just a couple of books written on it. It's very fascinating. If you read into it, hardly any public discussion about it. But it was an example of real and Art Collins and my dad, who was there. I mean, really, hard work, technical innovation. They designed the flight controls of the 747 on paper, right? This was sort of the process of creating great ideas and things that had huge impact, throughout the country. So, all the radio control systems, for the Apollo, when you see Apollo 13 and the guys, that have sort of the alien logo, that's the Collins logo, where they're strapping them in, and hooking up all the communication systems and that sort of stuff. And so it goes through that into trains, train control systems, everything, right? In terms of that. And so him in terms of influencing me around, understanding that, from an entrepreneurial standpoint, how that becomes a bigger and bigger business, that eventually was bought by Rockwell, which was a big conglomerate in the 70s and 80s. And he was eventually the president of that business in the 1990s. He then retired. Since then, Rockwell's been disbanded into a set of public companies, and Collins was a public company and then was bought, by Allied and then by Raytheon. And so you look back at that, 60-year, history of the, from when he started in the 1960s, and you realize how many different careers he had, different things that he had to do through that, and just the advice that he has around how to deal with problems and to think about the long term and things like that. So I'd say that's my biggest influence.
Cool. Sounds like he's had an interesting life as well. And tell us about Sarasota. You're a new Sarasota resident. How did you find Sarasota?
Yeah, I found Sarasota in the early 1990s. That's where we came to Siesta Key Beach for our spring break. I think it was either 1993, 94. And I think probably you've got a sense of it now that I am a planner, slightly a planner in life. And I thought to myself, even when I was in my early 20s, that this would be a wonderful place to have a company and or retire to. Right. And so when my parents were retiring, they were going into retirement in the late 1990s. I told them to buy a condo on Siesta Key Beach, sight unseen. And said, you guys should just come down here, and spend some time, right? And maybe you'll love it. And, lo and behold, they loved it and retired there. And so they, subsequently had bought a larger and larger space on Siesta Key. We built bought a small place on Siesta Key that we have just moved to. We're in the process of building something on Lido Key. And our kids had gone to college here in the last year. And we said, it's time to make the move that we've been thinking about, for 30 years, to Sarasota. And so that happened last fall, during last year, essentially. Right.
Yeah.
And we bought a small office in the Burns Court neighborhood down there in the historical neighborhood.
Awesome.
Old building down there near Laurel Park and everything. And so, it's great to have an ongoing business that I can run from and operate out of Sarasota, and can't wait to get more involved in the, community and the business community here. And it's just been starting to, reach out to people and various networks, to do that. Yeah,
for sure. And your team, you said it's a small but mighty team. They'll love coming to Sarasota and Siesta for team meetings and that kind of thing. And you've also been involved in Tiger 21, which is really neat, interesting organization. Tell us about Tiger 21 and kind of what your, not really role is there, but what you've been doing there, and what that organization's about.
Yeah. So I, about 5 years ago, I felt that I needed to start, it's been a decade pretty much only thinking about our kids and farmland opportunity and my wife. That was pretty much it, right? Build a business, our kids were growing up, that sort of thing. And I kind of decided it's probably time for me to start, building, I don't know if you would call it reconnecting to the world or what have you, but starting to build a network, beyond just what we were doing in the business, essentially, right? And thinking about investments, that would be outside of farmland or farmland opportunity as well. To my things I mentioned before, I was literally, running on a treadmill and exercising before some business meeting, meeting a client. And I saw Michael Sonnenfeld, talking on CNBC about Tiger 21. I said, well, what the heck? I'll just, you know, send my, you know, fill out the form, you know, and see if somebody contacts me. You know, it seemed like an interesting organization, lots of entrepreneurs, lots of real estate developers. You know, and I might, you know, learn a lot basically by joining it. And so that was the initial impetus to go into it. It was primarily around getting connected to the network of people that are also members there to learn from them. And then secondly, it was about, you know, looking at, you know, different things to invest in that were not just buying farmland or putting money into our company, basically, which is all I had done, you know, for over a decade.
Got it. And I hear the Sarasota, well, in the Tampa, and I'm sure Naples as well, but I hear Sarasota Tiger 21 is a pretty neat group of some interesting entrepreneurs with some unique backgrounds.
It is. It's a very interesting group. I mean, I think, you know, geographically, Tiger's in a lot of places, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And so you get, you know, different types of people just based on the location. You know, I think the Sarasota group has quite a few people that have sold a business and relocated to Sarasota because of all the great things Sarasota has to offer in terms of a place to live versus other places that will remain nameless. But yeah. But it's a good group. It's a lot of you know, people that have started a business, people that have sold a business, people that are in real estate. I think that's probably, you know, more than, you know, 2/3 or 75% of the members.
All right, excellent, Jay. Before we let you go, I got three rapid fire questions for you. I always ask people, are you ready? But it really doesn't matter because I'm going to ask you. So I hope you're ready. Okay, how many unread emails do you have right now?
I have less than 10. So I typically try to start the week with zero. We are not a email culture at all. Kind of funny as, you know, you have on the iPhone, you have the, like, what apps that you actually use, you know?
Yeah.
And my kids think it's hilarious that the most used, you know, application on my iPhone is, guess what? The telephone.
really the actual the actual phone
to, real people actually talking to real people. That's how I
occasionally well, more than occasionally, my 15-year-old son will come up on these podcasts and he's like my foil sometimes, but I have told him, you know, that thing you're holding in your hand, you're texting with people, you can actually call people on it actually works as a phone.
Yes, it does.
You and I are the same like that. Okay, so I'm curious on your answer on this one because you have an engineering mind. Are aliens real? Do you believe in aliens?
Or do I believe in aliens? I don't know if I can go on the record of that. Well, I certainly was growing up, I was a huge Star Trek fan. I mean, that's like, I mean, without saying, you know, Captain Kirk, Jean-Luc Picard were, you know, table stakes in terms of everything that I watched as a kid growing up. I would say I've looked at some farmland near Area 51 in Las Vegas a couple times. We have never bought something in Nevada at all. I think the chances are fairly remote that we, you know, have people walking amongst us. Yes, you know, aliens amongst us, I would say. Yeah.
Last question, and for our audience, this is being recorded right before the Super Bowl, so it's loosely related. Yeah. But what would you rather have, front row tickets to Taylor Swift or 50-yard line seats to the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. Taylor Swift concert tickets, definitely. We went and saw her when she was in Seattle here, I think it was last July or August. Yeah. And I mean, that the production there is just as good or even more, you know, precise and refined than an NFL football team in the Super Bowl. Let me tell you. Yeah. I mean, she's amazing, you know, in terms of the whole gamut of running her business to, you know, performing to, you know, it's just it's a sight to see. It's definitely, I mean, if you don't, you know, like her music or like her whatever, it's worth going to watch that concert to see, you know, quite a business machine, right? You know, in action. Yeah.
It is pretty amazing what she's, the economic impact of the Swifties is pretty deep. So awesome. Jay Girado, president of Farmland Opportunity and new-ish Sarasota resident. Thank you so much for joining us on the From the Corner Office podcast.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you for listening to the Business Observer From the Corner Office podcast. I'm your host, Mark Gordon. This podcast was produced by Reed Corley of The Corley Company in Sarasota. To hear other episodes or to learn more about the Business Observer, go to businessobserverfl.com.